We're going to be talking about that last song that they sang tonight. Those three little words that need to be said so often between the two of us. I love you. And how difficult at times it is for that to come out, even when we don't feel like it. So we're going to be talking about that. We've got a few books over here that are out of print. It's called Opposites Attack. Some of you have seen it. Unfortunately, we've only got 9 or 10 left, but you're welcome to pick one up over there for $5. Pretty good deal. So as long as they last, just pick one up, put $5 bill in the box, and it's yours. Let me read you a passage of Scripture here from, I'm not going to tell you where it's at. See if you know. It's the last 6 verses of a chapter in the Old Testament. Get you a little warm. You know, you're at least in the right testament. Beginning with verse 10. As the rain and the snow come down from heaven and do not return to it without watering the earth and making it bud and flourish, so that it yields seed for the sower and bread for the eater. So is my word that goes forth out of my mouth. It will not return to me empty, but it will accomplish what I desire and achieve the purpose for which I sent it. Now, do these next 2 verses sound familiar to you? As of recently, you will go out in joy and be led forth in peace. The mountains and the hills will burst into song before you. We just sang that, didn't we? First song we kicked off with this morning. And all the trees of the field will clap their hands. Instead of the thorn bush will grow the pine tree, and instead of the briars the myrtle will grow. This will be for the Lord's renown, for an everlasting sign which will not be destroyed. Isaiah 55, verses 10 to the end of the chapter. And two reasons for reading that this morning. One is because it's such a tremendous passage, and we just sang it, and you might not have recognized where it was from. But secondly, those last 2 verses, beginning with, "You will go out in joy and be led forth in peace," many, many, many years ago, was a passage that God gave to Carol and to me in a very, very discouraging and difficult situation. We were being evicted from not a home, but from a place of ministry out in Long Beach, California, with military people. And a bank had bought the building we were in. We had an absolutely fabulous location to reach Navy guys who would stroll up and down the main street there in Long Beach. And the bank had bought it, had sent us an eviction notice. And we absolutely had no idea what we were going to do. We were up on a third floor, 33 stairs up from the pavement, and guys would just flock in there and come in and eat sandwiches that women from various churches around the city would come in each day and prepare, and their favorite cakes and pies. And these guys would come in, they'd sit down, they'd grab a sandwich, a cup of coffee, and a piece of pie. And then we'd go sit down with them and start talking with them and eventually get around to spiritual matters. And so it was kind of like a honey attracting bees. You know, these guys loved to eat. And these ladies would come up every day and prepare their carrot and bologna sandwiches and bring their favorite pie and cake. And we had an outreach that was just absolutely fabulous. And then we got this eviction notice. And one morning I was at home, kneeling there beside my bed, praying about this whole thing. Lord, what do you want us to do? We've only got about 30 days to find out what you want us to do. And I was flipping through some passages, and I came across this passage. You will go out in joy and be led forth in peace. The mountains and the hills will burst into song before you, and the trees of the field will clap their hands. And instead of the thorn bush, in other words, instead of this being a bad deal, instead of the thorn bush will grow pine trees. It's going to be great. In fact, the interesting thing is that we were located on North Pine Avenue. And we were getting kicked out of North Pine Avenue. But instead of briars, the myrtle will grow up, and it will be for the Lord's renown. And it was. Within that 30-day period, we found another place off the beaten track that we had to endure for about 9 months. And then God opened up a place right on the main drag in Long Beach, on Ocean Boulevard. I mean, the Navy, there were hundreds of Navy guys that would walk back and forth in front of that place. It was an old dance hall. And God opened it up. We remodeled it. Some businessmen came in and did their thing and painted it up. And it was far better than the one we'd had before. God is in the business of meeting our needs and answering our prayer and giving us His promises from His Word. And every time I come across this passage, I think back those years ago when God gave me this and fulfilled it. He really did. Okay, Carol is going to come in just a moment, but let me just remind you where we were last night when we quit. We mentioned that marriage is a triangle, the husband, the wife, and God and their relationship to Him. Jeremiah 9, 23 and 24, let not the wise man glory in his wisdom. Let not the mighty man glory in his might. Let not the rich man glory in his riches. All of those things are easy to do. If we've got power and authority, it's easy to exercise that and be proud of it. And riches the same way. Wisdom the same way. But he says, let not the man that has these things do that, or woman, but let him that glory or boast in this, that he knows and understands me, that I am the Lord, which exercise loving kindness, judgment, and righteousness in the earth, for in these things I delight, saith the Lord. He delights in our getting to know Him better and better every day. But not only is it important that this husband and this wife get to know God, in order to really have a successful marriage, one that is meaningful and rewarding and fulfilling to both of us as husband and wife, it's important that we get to know each other as husband and wife. We got to work at that. And it's amazing to us how often we run into couples who really don't know each other, and they've been married for years, but they've just never taken the time or the trouble to study one another, to really concentrate on trying to understand that person that they've been living with all these years. And so that's what Carol is going to do now. She's going to come up and introduce us to this whole subject of really getting to know and understand each other as a husband and wife, and how we can do that in some practical ways. So, honey, come on up. It's always a privilege. I didn't really get a chance to introduce Carol last night, and it's always a privilege for me to introduce this lady to a group like you. We've been married for 45 years. She's my sweetheart, my lover. She's a wonderful mother to our daughter. She's a great grandmother to... she's not a great grandmother. She's a wonderful grandmother. She's a wonderful grandmother to our grandkids, and we just have a fabulous time together in this thing called marriage. And so it's a privilege for me to introduce to you Carol Mayhall, my sweetheart.
My best friend. One summer, a few years ago, Jack and I stepped out into our little patio, only to discover that during the night, some squirrels had dug through our overstuffed furniture, and there was stuffing everywhere. I looked around and I said, oh no, this makes me sick. Jack looked around and said, this makes me mad. I thought, oh, now every night we've got to pull in that porch furniture and every morning take it back out. Jack went down to the Humane Society, got a squirrel trapped five squirrels before he felt he had the right one, transported them way out someplace, and solved our problem. Same situation, two totally different reactions. And it happens all the time. One woman said, my mother, when she looked out of her window at the streets of the inner city, saw need. My father, when he looked out the same window to the same streets, he saw danger. Same situation, but entirely different reactions. And it does happen all the time. We have to live with these differences, my friends. We have to live with the personality type differences, the extrovert-introvert differences, our hang-ups, our idiosyncrasies, 1,001 things in which you react differently from one another. It's been said that God gave us two eyes with which to see things from a slightly different point of view. You only have one eye, you lose dimension, perspective. You see things flat. But when you have two eyes, you see things in the round. I think that's a wonderful picture of marriage. God made you two distinct and different individuals, complete individuals. But as you come together, you form a new thing, an entity, a couple that can become much more together than either one of you could by yourself if you let God do that for you. But it takes work. Proverbs 24:3-4 says, "By wisdom a house is built, and by understanding it is established. And by knowledge the rooms are filled with all precious and pleasant riches." But my friends, most of us have very little of that kind of wisdom. And most of us do not ask God daily for the kind of wisdom and knowledge that we need to continue learning about one another. Now, the Bible describes marriage as two becoming one flesh. This obviously is talking about in the physical realm or one flesh. But Jack and I feel that means so much more than that. We feel that it means that you're one, you are to become one in heart, in vision, in goals. You really are to become, as it were, best friends. We don't mean a lot of couples who will say they are best friends, but that's our goal. And in order to have that kind of relationship, it takes, of course, at least three things. It takes God's help. He's the only one that really understands that person you're married to. And we just need constant communication with God to pray daily, not only for wisdom daily, but for love daily. Charlie Shedd says, who is one of our favorite authors, "True love has no maximum. There's always new vistas ahead." And we have a couple here who's been married 50 years. We'll see. They've still got things to learn. Jack and I, at 45 years, we've still got things to learn. And I want to learn them, don't you? I don't want to stand still. So Jack and I make it a point to go to a marriage seminar ourselves every other year or so, because we want to keep learning. I read the books. I pick up things, and I want to ask God to help me to put those into practice so that our relationship can grow on a daily basis. So we need God's help. Secondly, in order to be best friends, I need to understand me. And I realize that many times I don't understand me. And there are times when I get very frustrated, when I get upset, when I get antsy, and I don't even know why. And of course, Jack, being able to read me like a book after all these years, if he sees that I'm disturbed about something, he immediately thinks it's his fault. And sometimes it is, and sometimes I want him to know that. But that's not fair. In fact, nothing is wrong is a phrase that should be stricken from any couple's vocabulary. We need to say, yes, there is something wrong. It does have to do with you. And I'll tell you about it in 10 minutes. If I tell you about it now, I'll cry. Or whatever, but we need to get it out. But you see, there are times when Jack will say, "What's wrong?" And I'll say, "Nothing." And why am I saying nothing? It's because I really don't know. And that's not fair to him. So I need to become a student of myself. And I've discovered that the best way to do that is to just, when something's going on inside of me, to just go before my Father, shut the door, and say to the Lord, "Help." James 1:5 says, "If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all men liberally, and it shall be given him." Boy, do I hang on to that. Lord, you promised wisdom, and I don't know what's going on inside of me. So give me wisdom to understand me. so that I can explain myself to my husband, so that we can become one, so that we can become best friends. Thirdly, I need to really understand Jack. Now, both of these, to understand me and to understand Jack, and of course to understand my father, are lifetime projects. This is not anything that we're going to know tomorrow. But we need to keep working at it. Ephesians 4:32 says in the Phillips translation, be kind to one another. Be understanding. Be as ready to forgive others as God for Christ's sake has forgiven you. Three essential commands for any relationship, but especially a marriage. You know, if we would only put this one into practice, every hour of the day, we would be the happiest creatures on earth, wouldn't we? We'd have the most wonderful relationships. Be kind to one another. So often we're the least kind to those we love the most. And if you don't believe me, just listen to mothers in supermarkets. But then it says, be understanding. A man once said, a long life is barely enough for a man and a woman to understand each other. And to be understood is to love. The man who understands one woman is qualified to understand pretty well everything. And the reverse is true. And yet, when Adam was lonely, God made for him not 10 friends, but one wife. And I'm glad. Then it says to be forgiving. You know, sometimes with us, we do need to have a marriage that is simply the union of two awful good forgivers. And what happens often in a relationship is that we get hurt. And though we may say we're sorry, or the other person says they're sorry, little scar tissue builds up around that hurt. And we kind of make a wall there. And then we're hurt again, and that scar tissue gets thicker. And we're hurt again and again and again until the walls are so thick and so high that we're simply living together without really living together. And some of you may be in that boat, and this is where you'll have to start this weekend. Is just thinking about forgiveness. Have I really forgiven my spouse for that thing way back or that thing that happened yesterday? Am I forgiving him or her as God for Christ's sake has forgiven me? How much has God for Christ's sake forgiven you? How much? Everything. Now, friends, we can't do that in ourselves, can we? I mean, it's not possible for us as a human being to have the power and the ability to do that except for God. And some of you may need to sit down with each other and say, you know, there's an awful lot of walls in our lives. And except for God, I can't get through them. But I want to. And can we pray and ask God to break those down and forgive each other and go on? Because that's God's command. And you know, one of the things that I love most about the Christian life, I love lots of things about the Christian life, but one of the things I love most is that God never will give us a command that He, in the power of His Holy Spirit, will not give us the ability to do. Aren't you glad? I mean, if I was faced with these commands, all of them, and thinking, oh, how can I do that? And I can't. Except God wouldn't be ethical if He said, Carol, be kind, and then not give me the ability to be kind, and to be forgiving, and to be understanding. One man said, when we quarrel, my wife becomes historical. And his friend said, don't you mean hysterical? And the other guy says, no, I mean historical. She brings up everything I ever did. And yet Proverbs 17:9 in the Living Bible says, love forgets mistakes. Nagging about them parts the best of friends. Do you see why Jack said we can't do it without God? But let's get back to understanding, because that's what we're going to talk about this morning. One minister's wife said this, if I could give one piece of advice, and only one, to wives everywhere, it would be this: study your man. Study him as if he were some rare and strange and fascinating animal, which he is. study his likes and dislikes, his strengths and weaknesses, his moods and mannerisms. Just loving a man is fine, but it's not enough. To live with one successfully, you have to know him. And to know him, you have to study him. Look around you and decide how many of the best marriages you know are ones where a wife, in a deep sense, actually knows her husband better than he knows himself. Knows what pleases him, knows what upsets him, knows what makes him laugh or makes him angry, knows when he needs encouragement, knows when he's too charged up about something and needs to be held back, knows, in other words, exactly what makes him tick. Whew. Now, if that isn't a lifetime job, I don't know what is. Because we're always changing, aren't we? Wives, do you know your husbands that well? Husbands, do you know your wives that well? That is part of the adventure of marriage. Now, I'm going to give you just four differences about Jack and me. These are just Jack Carroll differences. These are not necessarily men-women differences. So if you men find yourselves identifying with me, it doesn't mean you're feminine. It just means you're different than Jack and me. Our goal on this, my friends, is just to pique your interest so that you will begin a lifelong study on some of these differences. And maybe our book will help you on that. There's a lot of them in there. But we want you to study your differences so that you will be able to take those differences and use them instead of screaming. We named our book Opposites Attract, and then crossed it off and put attack. And we did that for a very reason, because often we are attracted to those opposite of us, aren't we, in courtship. And then we start living with those differences for a while, and pretty soon, whoa, we're really attacking each other because of the very differences that we were attracted to at first. Now, Jack is a very objective person. I am a very subjective person, and this has great implications in our relationship. To Jack, a fact is a fact is a fact. He can step back and take a detached view of things. To me, a fact is, slightly more than a fact or slightly less than a fact, depending on what mood I'm in. I can't detach myself from anything. I hop right in there and get involved. Now, the implications of this are great. We can have a couple over for dinner, and the man can say, where'd you get this meat? And Jack will say, well, down at the corner grocery. And I'll say, why? What's wrong with it? Jack will say that Jones is busy and can't come tomorrow, and I'll think, I wonder what we did to offend them. Now, subjective people do not take teasing well. There is no way that Jack can come through the door and say, hi, chubby, that I don't take it personally. You objective people, remember that. Jack is very essential-minded. I am very detail-minded. Jack focuses on the main subject, the most important thing to be considered. I see the little details, all the various things that are going on. Now, because Jack does not think the way that I do, I used to spend hours crying because I didn't think he was interested in people. I many times didn't think he was interested in me. And I'll show you what I mean in a minute. Jack would go to a week-long conferences many times, and as our daughter was growing up, he had an executive job and he needed to be gone. And I stayed home with our grade school daughter, the dog, the washing machine, dial a prayer, you know how it goes. And so when he would come home, I would, of course, be a star for adult conversation. And so I would greet him at the door with my biggest hug and kiss. And I would say, honey, tell me all about that conference. And he would tell me all about that conference. In 10 minutes flat. And I would think, he doesn't care enough to tell me about that conference. And if he doesn't care enough to tell me about that conference, then he must not love me the way I long to be loved. Always goes back to that for me. On the other hand, I would start to tell him about the neighbor down the street. You know, she's the one that, she has really long hair, but it's kind of, she wears it kind of twirled and with a deal in it. And it was her son, boy, he got into trouble. And you know, her aunt, by this time, I look at Jack and his eyes are kind of glazed and crossed. And I'm thinking, he's not listening. And I'm right. And I think, if he's not listening, then he's not interested in what I'm interested in. And if he's not interested in what I'm interested in, then he must not love me the way I long to be loved. Now, friends, I was wrong on both counts. I didn't understand my husband. You see, when Jack came back and told me about that conference in 10 minutes flat, what was he doing? He was focusing in on the main things, the most important things to be considered. In his way, he had told me all about that conference. And I didn't know that. Now, of course, since then, he has learned, and this is where you grow, that I want to hear about some of those really important things, you know, like who got engaged and who's going to have a baby and the best meal he had and a few of those little important things I want to hear about. So he remembers to tell me now. But I want you to know, I have learned how to boil a juicy four-hour story into 10 minutes flat. That's how love works. That's how you compromise. But the flip side of that is Jack realizes that there are times I have just got to get all the details out. And he's trained himself to listen. Not just with his ears, but with his person. And I love him for it. Now, detail-minded people like me get impressed by and distracted by a lot of little things, which can drive essential-minded people right up the wall. Jack will say, that's a good-looking car, but how does it run? Okay, that's the essential. I'll say, I just don't like the color. That's the detail. Jack will say, I like that speaker's ideas. And I'll say, did you notice his shirt matched his tie? Now, I'm exaggerating, but not much. And it wasn't that I didn't notice the speaker's idea. It was that I noticed something else, too. Not wrong, friends. Just different. Jack is a very logical person. I am a very emotional person. Probably already discovered that by now. Jack is inclined to study the evidence and in a step-by-step reasoning process reach a conclusion. I rely on my intuition, instinct, emotion to reach a conclusion. Many times the same conclusion. And my way's faster. Now, let me show you how this can work to become an asset rather than a liability. Someone has suggested that a person's intuition goes back to this mind of detail. Jack and I can go into a situation and we see two distinctly different sets of facts. I notice that raised eyebrow. I'm aware of that body posture, that tone of voice. I filter all these 20 little details through the computer of my mind and it comes out a feeling, if you will, an intuition. Jack sees another set of things. We will come away from a situation, and Jack often asks, honey, how did you feel about that situation? I need that word, because I cannot tell him that I saw all these little things, not even aware that I saw all these little things. So he says, how did you feel about that situation? I will tell him. He filters that back through his computer, his very logical computer. We can go back into a situation, ask some other questions, and you see we come out with a picture in the round. Isn't that great? That's how God has fitted us together just in this one thing. But it takes work to figure that out. How you can turn those things from assets, from liabilities into assets. Now, logical people think in a straight line, like that. Emotional people think all around, and we talk that way too. Sorry about that. And we'll talk on communication later. And, of course, the cardinal rule in communication is to say what you mean and mean what you say, but Jack realizes I'm never going to get there. But anyway, for instance, we're going out to dinner, and I say to Jack, I suppose I ought to go change. And Jack will say, well, why don't you? And I'll say, well, don't you like what I've got on? And he'll say, well, it's okay, but you said you were going to change. And I'll say, oh, I was just saying that, see if it was okay not to. Isn't that awful? Now, I'm working on this. I really am. I'm working on this. And there are times now I say, erase that. What I really mean is, and I try to hit it. But it's hard for me. Now, lastly, Jack uses speech to convey facts and ideas. I use speech often to express feelings and emotions. Very, very important to understand this one between the two of you. We're looking at a moon. Great, big, gorgeous moon. And I say, oh, isn't that a beautiful moon? Well, now, what am I saying? I am saying that moon makes me feel romantic. And if Jack comes back with, yes, that's bright enough to shoot a golf ball by. He actually said that one time. But he smiled. He knew exactly what I was saying. It's raining outside. See, I was expressing a feeling in that statement. It's raining outside, and I look outside, and I say, it's raining outside. Well, what am I saying? I could be saying a number of things. I could be saying, oh, it's raining outside. That makes me feel so energetic, I'm going to clean house like crazy all day. Or I could be saying, oh, it's raining outside. That makes me feel kind of depressed. But chances are, I am expressing a feeling in a statement like that. Jack looks outside. He says, it's raining outside. Well, what is he saying? Heavens have parted and little drops of moisture are falling to the ground. He is expressing a fact. I am expressing a feeling. Friends, I have cried buckets over this one, not understanding my husband. I was just studying this particular characteristic. When I backed the car out of the garage a little too fast, it's one of the difficulties of being a fast person, and I took a little piece of the garage with the back fender out. And I came in the house and I says, oh, I feel awful. You just can't imagine what it was like when that car went crunch. And Jack stopped me just like that and he said, never mind that. What happened? Oh, I thought, he doesn't care. He doesn't care how I'm feeling. And if he doesn't care how I'm feeling, then he must not love me the way I long to be loved. But you know, by that time I'd been studying about my husband. And my next thought was, no, that is not true. Jack does care. Jack does love me. Jack will listen to my feelings. He's just got to have the facts first. So I told him the facts. But that is how we begin to understand and grow. And you know, as you do this, friends, you're able to relate to the multitudes of people out there that are also not like you. And you begin to live in Christ and grow in Christ in a way that you maybe never could before. One other thing here. I could name you many other differences. Jack's going to give you a couple more. But one of the things that is imperative in learning about one another is really your language of love. How do you express love primarily? If I were to go around right now and I were to ask you that question, would you be able to answer how your mate expresses love? Or what is your first language of love? Do you know? Maybe something you want to take a walk and discuss this afternoon. The psychologists tell us that there are five basic ways of expressing love. Jack and I have added two because ours didn't fit in any of these, our primary one. And these are what they are. First one is words. some people have to be told. Not just the words, I love you, but the encouraging words. Hey, that was great. You're doing super, honey. Man, I'd rather be married to you than anybody else in the whole world. Some people dry up and die if they don't hear the words, because their primary way of hearing love is through words. You better know it. Now, our whole focus here needs to be the fact that we discover the primary way and appreciate it. Then we can begin giving it back, for one thing. But also we can develop the other languages of love that are so also meaningful and grow in our love relationship with one another. Secondly is touch. Some of us are huggers and kissers. And if Jack doesn't give me a hug often, I begin to feel very distant from him. I need to be touched. This one person said, you need 4 hugs a day just to be maintained, and 8 hugs a day to grow, and 12 hugs a day to really be excited about life, you know. Well, that's me. I need that. So some people have to have the touch. Thirdly is time. And this is another one of the languages of love that I have. I need time, significant, deep, communicating time with my husband. Or I begin again to feel very distant from him. This is not time just in front of the television or even time on the golf course. It's time sitting down and really sharing intimately and deeply in our lives. Fourthly is gifts. Some people are gift givers. You have a friend probably who just is always thinking up little things that you mentioned, and she'll will bring you this at odd moments. By the way, if you have a friend like that, remember that she hears your love in the same way best. So think about little things that you can give them back. But some people just have a language of love that is gifts. Fifthly is deeds. I have talked to many wives who have said to me, oh, you know, my husband works so hard, but he doesn't spend time with me. He's always working. Yeah, he supports our family and he's faithful, and I appreciate that, but he never brings me flowers. A lot of wives say that to me. And I said, dear wife, are you appreciating that language of love that your husband is giving you? He's killing himself for you. And in doing so, he is saying, I love you. Are you even encouraging him in that? Well, that's not what I want to hear. If we can appreciate our husband's language of love, if it happens to be this one, really praise him and thank him for it, then maybe the secondary languages of love that you need to hear will begin to develop. But if you ignore his language of love and don't appreciate it, your relationship is up against a brick wall right there. Jack is a caregiver. In fact, I identified so much with Elizabeth Elliot's dedication of her book on asking God why, and she dedicates it to her husband, Lars Grin, and she says this, to my husband, Lars Grin, who builds the fences around me and stands on all sides. Not to keep her in, but to protect her. And that's the way I feel about Jack, and I so appreciate that. He's a caregiver for me, and I'm kind of a nut, and I know it. And I just feel his protection and his care in many, many, many areas. And I appreciate that. Now, Jack and I added two here. Because Jack hears my love a great many times through my loyalty to him. When Jack says to me, kind of longingly, honey, are you really with me in this? I think, whoops, I have not communicated to him that right or wrong, honey, I'm 100% with you. And I realize that that has communicated to him a lack of love. He needs me to be right there at his side, Jack and me against the world. He needs it. It's the way he hears my love. On the other hand, I hear his love. One of the primary ways is his acceptance of me. As I said, I'm kind of a nut, and I have this wild imagination that, you know, gets ideas from any old place. But to my knowledge, I can never remember Jack saying, Carol, that's got to be the dumbest idea you ever came up with. He may have thought it, but he's never said it. What has that done for me? Well, it's made me free to be me. It's given him the advantage of the one idea out of 100 that might be worth something. But it's also made us one. It's made us best friends. And I am so grateful. Differences, frustrating and fascinating. But through them, God will help you grow. I'm going to give you a little quiz, and then Jack's going to come up and finish this off. I'm going to let you give a chance to stand up. So get a little piece of paper and don't look. This is just a fun little quiz. Don't worry about it. I want to know what you know about each other. Okay? Number one, what is your spouse's favorite color? What is your spouse's favorite color? Boy, some of you are thinking really hard about that. They may not have a favorite color. That would be an answer. And no checking. Okay? Ready? Second, what is your spouse's favorite foreign food? Italian, Chinese, Southern fried chicken doesn't count. What is your spouse's favorite foreign food? Third question, what is the color of your spouse's toothbrush? I never can think of that one. Jack changes them too often. What is the color of your what is the color of your spouse's toothbrush? Okay, got those? Take 1 minute, stand up, compare answers, see how you did.
Okay, have a seat, will you, folks? We did that little exercise one time, and a guy in the back of the room, you could hear him all over the auditorium, said, "You mean you don't know the color of my toothbrush?" We don't mean for that to start a fight between the two of you. I just got a new one recently the dentist gave me, and I'm not even sure what color it is. It's one of those vague colors. Let me try and put all of this that we're talking about in a biblical context. And this may be of help to you as you think about it. Turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 12, if you will. Beginning with verse 14. Now, this passage, most of you are probably familiar with it. It's talking about the body of Christ, and it makes a comparison of the body of Christ, which is comprised of all of us here who are believers, all believers all over the world. But it's making a comparison of that biblical concept to our physical body. Now, most of the time when we hear a message on this particular passage, that is what is emphasized, the fact that we are all part of the body of Christ, and it's a great big mass of people all over the world who have this relationship to each other because we are in Christ. And that is very accurate. That is a very realistic and a very accurate interpretation of this passage. But I want you to think about it this morning in just a little bit different way. If the two of you, as a husband and a wife, are believers in Jesus Christ, then you are a part of the body of Christ. The two of you are. You are individually. But what I want you to do as I read this, beginning with verse 14, is I want you to think about it in the context of your marriage. Apply this just to the two of you and see if it doesn't have something to say to you in terms of this matter of differences that we've been talking about. Verse 14. Now the body is not made up of one part, but of many. If the foot should say, because I'm not a hand, I do not belong to the body, it would not for that reason cease to be a part of the body. And if the ear should say, because I'm not an eye, I do not belong to the body, it would not for that reason cease to be a part of the body. If the whole body were an eye, where would the sense of hearing be? If the whole body were an ear, where would the sense of smell be? Now you begin to get the picture here as it relates to just the two of you. See, what are you? Are you an eye, a knee, an elbow? What's your spouse? Probably something different in many respects. Well, that's what it's talking about here. Now notice the next verse. Verse 18. But in fact, God has arranged the parts in the body, every one of them, just as He wanted them to be. If we could, as married couples, could only grasp that thought, that idea, that concept that God is saying, that truth, that the reason that you are hooked up together, different than one another, is by God's arrangement. He planned it. So why fight it, huh? Let's make it work for us. Rather than kicking against God's plan for us, let's figure, hey, we're in this for keeps. This is what God has for us. Let's figure out how to make this work in harmony and get on with the job. But in fact, God has arranged the parts of the body, every one of them, just as He wanted them to be. If you were all one part, where would the body be? As it is, there are many parts, but one body. Now that's talking about the way we function individually, but then as a married couple, how we need to learn to function together. That's what that's talking about. Now in verse 21, he shifts gears. And he begins to talk about the fact, okay, that's the way we function, but we need each other. We can't operate separately. We need each other. The eye cannot say to the hand, I don't need you. The head cannot say to the feet, I don't need you. On the contrary, those parts of the body that seem to be weaker are indispensable. And the parts that we think are less honorable, we treat with special honor. And the parts that are unpresentable are treated with special modesty, while our presentable parts need no special treatment. Now notice this, but God has combined the members of the body and has given greater honor to the parts that lacked it. Verse 25, so that, now this is God's goal for you, for us, as a married couple. So that there should be no division in the body. No division between you as a husband and a wife. Okay, we function differently. We've got these differences. We are different. But what we've got to work at in order to accomplish God's plan of no division or unity between us is we've got to take these differences and make them work for us rather than against us. Now, we've been talking about that, but here it is right in the Bible. See, this is God's plan. And I think this is wonderful. I really do. So that there should be no division in the body, but that its parts should have equal concern for each other. If one part suffers, every part suffers with it. If one part is honored, every part rejoices with it. The give and take of our relationship. When she's got a major grievance, he enters into that, or vice versa. When he is honored, she enters into that, and vice versa. We rejoice together, we cry together, because we're really with each other. There is harmony and unity, and that is God's plan for us as married couples, as a part of His body. It's not easy. There's all kinds of things, as Carol's been mentioning, that can contribute to the divisiveness of this matter of differences between us. When we first got married, one of the things that early on in the game reared its ugly head had to do with a family background characteristic. Both Carol and I were raised in Christian homes, and the older we've grown, the more we've appreciated that. Our moms and her mom and dad, my mom and dad, really they not only taught us the Bible, they lived it around us. Neither of them were what would be termed saints. I mean, they weren't perfect. They had their fallacies. They were human beings. But we had terrific role models, and we really appreciated that. But there were many things in her family and my family that were different. For instance, one of them that we first learned about was how you show affection to each other, appreciation. Carol came from a family of huggers and kissers. That was the way that they just spontaneously would thank one another and show appreciation for each other. They'd just grab each other and give each other a hug and a kiss. I came from an entirely different background. I can never remember my dad and mom hugging me and kissing me when I was growing up. Oh, on occasion, when I'd get hurt or something, and mom would take me up on her lap and give me a hug and see me through the crying. But it wasn't a common occurrence in our family. There was never any doubt in my mind that my parents loved me, but it was shown in different ways. So when we got hooked up together, I'd come home from work, and there she'd be to warmly greet me. She'd throw her arms around me, give me a hug and a kiss. And I wasn't used to that. I mean, the romantic setting is okay, but, just an ordinary run-of-the-mill coming in the back door type of thing, that I just didn't know how to handle hugging and kissing in that kind of a situation. And so, I rebelled against it, and I just kind of stand there, like a telephone pole. I just, okay, let's get this over with. Hugging and kissing a telephone pole is no fun. And so after a few weeks of that, I began to realize that something was going to have to be done, because I could tell Carol was getting a little bit miffed by all this. The thing that probably brought the whole thing to a head was, we got married in September, and so that first Christmas, the next December, we went up to Three Rivers, Michigan for her to be with her parents and Christmas. And she's got a brother, an older brother, and a younger sister, and there were a couple of aunts and uncles there, and kids and cousins and so forth. And so Carol and I had gone together and gotten Christmas presents for everybody that we knew that was going to be there, and we drove up to Three Rivers and had a great time until we started opening presents. And I will never forget the scene. She and I were sitting on a couch across the room from her older brother, and he was opening our present. And, he ripped the paper off of it and opened the box and made this giant exclamation of how thrilled, man, this is great. And he jumped up out of his seat, came roaring across the room, grabbed Carol out up from her seat, put his arms around her, hugged her, and gave her a kiss. Guess who was next in line? Oh, man, I tell you. I died 1,000 deaths. And, I mean, that was not only her brother, it was her sister, it was the cousins, it was her dad. I mean, the most excruciating Christmas I'd ever spent in my life. I just didn't know how to handle it. Well, we got back home, and this meeting me at the door and hugging and kissing continued, but finally I realized, hey, we got to do something about this. And so we sat down one evening and began to talk about it. And, eventually she wanted to know, well, honey, don't you want me to do it? Well, I'd been experiencing it now for long enough to realize that I had begun to like it. But I just didn't know how to handle it. I didn't know how to respond. And so as we talked about it, I told her, I says, no, I think I want to learn how to do this. I'm not totally positive, but I'd like to give it a shot. Honey, will you help me? So Carol became my hugging and kissing coach. And so I'd come in the door the next night, and there she'd be, threw her arms around me, gave me a hug and a kiss. There I was standing ramrod. She said, now, honey, relax. So, okay, I relax. And she says, now put your arms around me. So, I get my arms around her. Now squeeze a little bit. And, little by little, she gave me these blow-by-blow instructions on how to do this. And, little by little, it became more and more natural. And I'd say, it probably took me a month to get to the place where I really knew what I was doing and how to do it right and how to respond properly. And I kept practicing. And, you know, they say practice, at least the right kind of practice, makes perfect. And I got, well, you know, after 45 years now, but I can hug and kiss with the best of them. But see, something had to give there. We had faced a situation that either she was going to stop doing it or I was going to learn how. It had to go one way or the other. Change is the name of the game in marriage. And as I look back on that, I am so glad I went Carol's way. Not only because of the enjoyment that it's given both of us, and especially me over the years now that I've learned to really appreciate it and can enter into it and do it easily, and but also because of certain kinds of situations we have found ourselves in over the years where hugging and kissing was the culture. It was a part of the culture. We first moved to Colorado Springs 20 years ago plus. Met a young dentist and his wife early on, and they lived out in the Broadmoor area, and they found out we did this marriage thing, and they invited us. We were sitting having dinner with them one night. They said, would you and Carol be willing to come over to our house maybe for 4 or 5 weeks in a row on a Tuesday or a Thursday night, and we will invite some of our friends over, and we just sit there and talk about marriage, and you can share some stuff, and we can interact with it. Well, yeah, we'd love to. It'd be terrific. So they set that up, and it was every Tuesday night for about 5 weeks. Well, you know, we weren't used to that cultural part of Colorado Springs. The Broadmoor is where the up-and-outers live, and they have a kind of a culture of their own. So we arrived on the scene, and the first thing that this couple did was he gave Carol a hug and a kiss on the cheek, and his wife did the same with me. And, you know, I mean, it was no big deal. I just responded in kind. I learned from her how to do that. But every couple who came, we went through that. Now, what if I hadn't known how to do that? What if I'd have given this? You think they'd have listened to anything we had to say? No way. What kind of a guy is this? You know, that's how it would have gone. So I'm so glad, and we found ourselves in a number of situations like that, where it's just been a natural thing to do in that setting. We were in France one time and ran into that. And you know, it took us 45 minutes to say goodbye to about 12 couples because of all the hugging and kissing that goes on. So where are you in this matter of being willing to make adjustments in your life? I've run into husbands. I suppose there are wives like this too, but I run into husbands sometimes, and they may not say it to their wives, but their attitude is, look, she knew what I was like when she married me. She can learn to live with it. Gee. Terrible. What an attitude to have. Life can be fun. It can be exciting if we're willing to try new things and make some adjustments and changes and give and take and let the flow between us really go. Another thing that we run into from time to time is this business of introvert-extrovert difference. And this is quite common with married couples. Carol is obviously the extrovert. Between Mike and Pam, who do you think is the extrovert? Who's the introvert there? Huh? The singers. Pam, obviously. I mean, she's the... Go, outgoing, you know, get us going. And Mike just kind of very casually, you know, goes along with it. He's got his part to play, she's got her part to play. Well, that's the way it is with Carol and me. I have to admit that this has never, ever been a problem between us, because early on in the game, I learned to appreciate her outgoing aggressiveness, talkative, and it contributed so much to what I lacked that I just... Man, this is great having a wife like this. Let's capitalize on it and get on with the show. And that's the way I've always felt about it. Because, you know, I can stand there and not have to say much. One time we had a young couple. He was a doctor, and his wife came through town and stayed overnight with us a couple of nights. And he and I were sitting there the second morning having an extra cup of coffee, and the gals had gone off shopping or something. And we were just talking, and he said, "Jack, could I ask you a very personal question?" I said, "Sure." He says, "Well, I've noticed that your wife, Carol, and my wife, Pat, are very much alike." And then he described this outgoing, talkative, bubbly personality. And I agreed with him. His wife, Pat, and my wife, Carol, were very much alike. He says, "Then I've noticed you and I are quite a bit alike. We're not quite as outgoing, more reserved, don't always know what to say in certain kinds of situations. And, you know, not exactly wallflowers, but, you know, more reserved." And I agreed with him on that. We were alike in that. But here was his question. How do you handle that problem? Underline the word problem. Well, I wanted to pursue that because to me it wasn't a problem, but obviously it was to him. And as I began to draw him out, I found out that there were certain kinds of situations in which they found themselves as a couple where he, in fact, was intimidated and sometimes threatened by her outgoing personality because he didn't know how to handle himself like she did in those situations. So we continued to talk about it, and I told him, I said, "Well, I said, Dave, it really isn't a problem to me, but let me tell you why. I said, Carol is such an asset in making up for what I lack in this area that I have learned over the years how to capitalize on it. For instance, I said, I hate small talk when we're with a group of people, you know, and the conversations just deteriorates to last week's football game or the weather or, you know, why did the baseball go on strike and stuff like that, you know. It's just mundane. I can take maybe 10 or 12 minutes of that, and then I just tune out. And if we're standing around at a party and the three or four couples standing there talking, and that is the tone of the conversation, it goes on like that. After about 10 minutes, I just tune out, go back to the office and start working on some project that I'm still thinking about back there, a personnel decision or some thing that we know how to work out financially or a budget or something. And I says, but I keep a very intelligent look on my face. Nobody knows that I'm gone mentally. Except Carol. She says she sees something in my eyes that she knows I've departed the premises mentally. And when that happens, she picks up on the conversation, says twice as much as she ordinarily would, and so they don't even miss me. And I said, now that is a tremendous asset. Well, he kind of smiled, and I said, of course, you know, somebody always ends up asking me a question, you know, somewhere along the line. And I said, well, Jack, what do you think about it? Well, I don't even hear what they're saying. You know, I don't hear the question. But Carol knows, and so she'll say, honey, that brings me to. She'll repeat the question. I give them an answer. It's small talk. It doesn't matter what I say. You know, that'll fit in. And they go on with their conversation, and I go back to work. Now, that to me is a tremendous asset. And, well, as we continued to talk about this, Dave began to see that he had a tremendous wife. She had a personality that he had never really learned to capitalize on and take advantage of and utilize in their relationship with each other and in certain situations where she could do a far better job for both of them and just, you know, turn them loose and say, sick them, honey. Why not? So, and we've kept in touch with him over the years. And he has grown in his appreciation of his wife, Pat's outgoing personality. And they're more in love now than they ever were before. You know, I don't know where you're at on this. It doesn't always work that way. Sometimes the guy is the extrovert. And it's the wife who is kind of... But you need to learn how to capitalize on it and make it work for you in your relationship. Now, about 5 or 6, it's probably been a little bit longer than that, 7 years ago, Carol and I came across a new definition of extrovert and introvert that we had never seen before. And it has helped us so much to understand ourselves and each other that let me share it with you. Because this is not what we normally think of when we think of an extrovert. An extrovert draws strength and stimulation from the external world of people and things. Now think about that. We always think of an extrovert as being that very talkative, outgoing, bubbly type of personality. And many times they are. But but the real heart of that has to do with this. I mean, what is really inside of an extrovert is that they are stimulated by that. They draw strength from that, from the externals out there, people especially, group situations. I mean, really turn them on. They get their batteries recharged in that kind of a situation. I mean, I can't understand that. It just blows my mind because I'm an introvert. Whereas an introvert draws strength and stimulation from within, the inner world of thought and reflection. Where I get my batteries recharged as an introvert is getting alone, up in my study, by myself, my feet propped up, and just sitting kind of thinking about some deal that I'm wrestling with or struggling with. How do we handle this? Or how do I do that? And I come out of that, man, I'm ready to go. Because that's how I get my batteries recharged. Well, this has helped us a lot in understanding each other and understanding ourselves. Now, let's talk about the wedding reception. I mentioned that last night, you remember? Okay. I cannot think of any situation that is tougher for an introvert to handle than a wedding reception. I mean, you got wall-to-wall people, most of them strangers, and here an introvert gets tossed in the middle of all that, and he's got to relate, or she's got to relate. Boy, that is tough to do. And that's why, you know, Carol says, well, 2 hours will do it, and 10 or 15 minutes is about all I can take, usually. So how do you handle a situation like it? Because we're all going to end up going to wedding receptions, and we're all going to end up finding ourselves in certain kinds of situations where we're like that. I mean, we introverts have got to find ourselves relating to a whole bunch of people, and how do you handle it? Well, one thing I try to do, which helps me, is I try to find a buddy that we have a common interest, and he and I can get over in the corner and just go at it, just the two of us. Now, that's not too hard for me to do. I can do that. In fact, I enjoy that. But this hop, skipping, and jumping around the room to, you know, howdy and handshake with everybody and small talk for a couple of minutes with each little group of people, oh, boy, that's tough on me. You know, I've learned to do it for a little while, but it's hard. So wedding receptions are really not in my bag. One time, I came up with what I thought was a brilliant idea on how to handle this. I had brought a good book with me, and I left it in the car. And so after about 10 minutes, and there was nobody there that I knew. And so after about 10 minutes, I found Carol, and she was, you know, having a great time interacting with a little group of people. And when there was a pause in the conversation, I put my hand on her shoulder, and I said, honey, I'm going to go out in the car and read for a while. Whenever you're ready to come, why, just come on out in the car. Well, I could tell the chill in the air immediately. And the mistake that I made is not talking it over with her first and telling her what I was going to do or discussing it. So, you know, we had a little flap over that one. But then we did talk about it. And it was about that time that we came across these definitions. And see, that's what I was doing. She was doing her thing, I was doing my thing. And once we understood that, it was easy for her to accept the fact that I could leave, go out in the car, read my book, she could stay there, because it really didn't, I didn't care how long she stayed. I mean, if she wanted to stay an hour, fine, I was having a great time, and she was having a great time. Well, now that's how we handle it. I mean, there are occasions when I'll stick around for the whole time, or there are occasions when she wants to get out of there in 20 minutes. I mean, it isn't always the same. But we've got an understanding now with each other that meets both of our needs, significant difference, but how do you handle those kind of things? Well, that's what you got to work at. Those are the kind of things you got to think through on. You got to be a little creative and come up with ways that both of you can feel comfortable and have your needs met and yet agree on it. That's what we mean by working. at this thing of the differences. Let me just share one. I better not. I need to tell you a story, give you four words, and then we got to quit. We're running out of time. Four words that summarize everything we've been talking about. Knowing, understanding, adjusting, and accepting. Knowing, standing back, observing, getting to know that person. Study your man as though he were some wild and fascinating animal, which he is, vice versa. Understanding goes a step beyond that. It's not just standing back and observing. In order to understand somebody, you've got to talk. You've got to get behind the why of it. And in order to do that, you've got to communicate. And I think another thing you've got to do is you've got to pray and ask God for wisdom, the James 1:5 type of wisdom. Then we've got to be willing to make adjustments, to change. Both of us do. Sometimes it's both of us got to change. Sometimes it's one. Sometimes it's the other. And then fourthly, we've got to be willing to accept each other in certain situations where that's all that can be done. Just accept them the way they are and recognize, hey, it's just different. It's not wrong. Now, the thing we need to be careful of here is that we don't use acceptance as a cop-out for something that we need to change. In other words, tell our spouse, hey, look, I can't change that. You're just going to have to accept me. When in reality, if we really worked at it, we could make some fine-tuning there and make some adjustments. So we need to be careful of those two things. Now let me tell you a little story that illustrates all four of those. A number of years ago, Carol and I were coming back from about 3 weeks down in Florida, the latter part of January, early February. We'd been down there on business. We'd spoken at several conferences. I had a job then with the NAS that was caused me to enter. I was in a leadership role. And I was interacting with some of the teams down there in Florida. And we came away from those 3 weeks absolutely exhausted, anxious to get home. And we flew from Orlando into Dallas-Fort Worth, and then from DFW, we're going to fly into Colorado Springs. Well, just as we were coming into DFW Airport to land, the pilot came on the intercom, and he says, folks, things are really bad down there. The Dallas-Fort Worth area has experienced one of the worst cold snaps and ice storms that they've had in years. And so it's going to be a little tricky getting in there, and I don't know what to expect once we get on the ground. Well, we got on the ground, and you could feel the plane skid a little bit on the icy runways. We pulled up to the terminal, walked off the airplane, and nothing was working. I mean, the electricity was out. The clocks weren't working. There was no heat. There were a few of these emergency battery-type lights around. Of course, you get from one terminal to another at DFW on these trains, which run by electricity. There was no electricity, so the trains weren't working. And so Carol and I found ourselves worn out, exhausted, anxious to get home. It was about 10 o'clock at night, standing outside in the cold, waiting for a bus to take us from the terminal we were at to the terminal we needed to get at to catch our plane home to Colorado Springs. And I was standing there, you know, frustrated by the whole situation, not knowing how to respond, standing there, hands in pockets, looking down at the ground, minding my own business, not saying a word. Carol was standing next to me. And there was a little old lady next to her who was very concerned about whether or not she was going to get home that night and get to sleep in her own bed. And so Carol was kind of cheering her up and saying, don't worry, honey. Everything is running late. The bus will be here in a little while. It'll get you to your terminal. Your plane will be waiting for you. You get home tonight, and on and on. Yak, 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 yak. Well, pretty soon, this yakking over here began to penetrate my thinking, and I got a little irritated. And so I doubled up my fist, and I just kind of nudged her on the thigh. And nonverbal communication, that meant, shut up. She got the message. She didn't talk to me the rest of the way home. Within 10 seconds after I had done that, I knew that I had made a terrible mistake. And so, you know, you do the best you can. You try to make up for it, apologize, etc. But nothing seemed to work. The bus finally came. We got on. We sat down. I put my arm around her, gave her a little squeeze. And I said, honey, I'm sorry. Will you forgive me? I wasn't thinking about you. I was thinking about myself. And she kind of grunted. I knew that was not forgiveness. Finally got on the airplane, and I tried it two or three more times. And finally, by the time we got home, about 2 o'clock in the morning, she had forgiven me. We'd made up, and we laid our heads on the pillow at peace with each other. Now, most married couples, when something like that happens, there's a flap between them for some reason or other, and they finally get it settled between them. There's kind of a, wow, I'm glad that's over. Kind of a relief that, you know, we've gotten through that and it's behind us now. Let's get on with the rest of life. There are not very many couples that we run into who are willing to take the time and the trouble to go back and figure out what happened. Why did that happen? What caused it? When a conflict arises and then it's over and you get it settled and you're at peace with each other, folks, let me tell you something. That situation affords you as a married couple, us as a married couple, one of the greatest opportunities to get to know and understand each other than you'll ever have in your married life. Conflict needs to be turned into a very positive thing once it's settled. And so what Carol and I did the next day, after we'd had a good night's sleep, we rested up, the next day we sat down and we began to talk about and try to analyze what had happened back there standing in the cold at the curb at the Dallas-Fort Worth airport. Because our responses to the same set of circumstances was entirely opposite. I was standing there quietly, minding my own business, doing nothing, not saying a word. Carol was next to me. We both felt the same way. We were cold. We were tired. We were frustrated by the out-of-control situation, and yet she was over here talking up a storm. Now, why? We'd never figured that one out before. So we sat down and we began to talk about it. And I was telling Carol, you know, what was going on in my mind. I was standing there, hands in pockets, looking down at the ground, trying to solve this problem we had. See, I am a problem solver by nature. My daughter has often told me, Dad, if you didn't have a problem to solve, you'd find one. And she's probably right. And so, boy, I had a dilly here. I was having an imaginary conversation with the airport manager. And he and I were trying to figure out how to get things back on track, how to get the electricity back on, get the trains running, get the airport lights on, get the heat back on, get the planes back on schedule. And, you know, we were really going at it, and I was trying to solve this problem. Well, when I'm working like that, I don't like outside interference. And so when this yakking began to penetrate my thinking, that irritated me. And that was what caused the nudge on the thigh, which was wrong. And I had to apologize for it. Well, we got talking about what Carol was going on with her. Why all this talk over here? Well, what came out of that was that when Carol finds herself in that kind of a situation, the thing that helps her cope more than anything else is forced cheerfulness. She forces herself inwardly to be cheerful about a situation that is uncheerful. And one of the things that helps her do that is to cheer up somebody else. So this little old lady here was her victim. And she was going about trying to cheer her up. Well, you know, once we got all that out, it gave us a great deal more of understanding about ourselves and about each other than we'd ever had before, given a similar set of circumstances. Well, near the end of that conversation, my wife can think up really tough questions sometimes. She says, well, honey, next time that happens, what do you want me to do? Because she knew that I had been irritated with her response. Well, guys, let me give you a little tip. When your wife asks you that kind of a question under similar circumstances, you better think about your answer because you're going to have to live with it the rest of your life. And I did. I thought about it, and I wanted to be as honest as I possibly could, much as I knew my own mind. And I said, honey, I want you to be yourself. But see, now I understood what was going on. She understood what was going on with me, and I understood what was going on with her. And sure enough, about 3 months later, we found ourselves in a similar situation. And there I was, standing there, hands in pockets, looking down at the ground. She was next to me. Next to her was a little 12-year-old boy who was lost. And she was trying to cheer him up. Don't worry, we'll find your parents. You just settle down, relax, on and on. Yak, 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 yak. Well, finally, I began to hear the yakking over here. But now I knew what was happening, see? I knew why she was doing this. And why she was doing it was okay. Not wrong, just different. And so inwardly, I kind of said to myself, I chuckled, and I didn't say it out loud. I said, you know, sick of honey, just have at it. And I went on and got back to work and solving this problem we had. Now, occasionally when I've told that story, someone will come up to me afterwards and they'll say, Jack, why was it so hard for Carol to forgive you? I mean, she kept you out there on the hook dangling for several hours. Yeah, that's right. Well, I had to figure that out. You remember when, just a few minutes ago, she was talking about languages of love? What is the one that she hears from me the most? Huh? Acceptance. My acceptance of her. What was the nudge on the thigh? Lack of acceptance. I mean, the major thing she hears from me in my love is my acceptance of her. And the nudge on the thigh was, man, that was a serious blow. Because I was saying, hey, what you're doing is unacceptable. Once I figured that out, boy, there are no more nudges on the thigh, I tell you that, huh? Yeah. Now let me ask you a question. Who was right and who was wrong? See, it's not a matter of right and wrong, is it? It's a matter of difference. If we could only get that through our heads. Not wrong, just different.